listeners, welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. You know you've got a fabulous read ahead when early in the story, you see the book setting come alive, become as central to the novel as the main characters. I've combed recent releases and found a great bunch of titles that brilliantly convey a sense of place. England, Africa, Singapore, Paris, and more. Within a few pages, we are transported to a place and a moment in time. We're offered a unique opportunity to be there, to experience it. My guest today, Francine Prose, conjures up Paris 1932 in her critically acclaimed Lovers at the Chameleon Club. Reviewers have found it a compelling, multi-layered novel of Europe directly before World War II. So, let's hop on our literary transport and turn to page one of the book report. Ayelet Waldman's Love and Treasure begins in Maine, 2012. An old man is dying with the weight of a plundered necklace on his conscience. As a U.S. Army captain in 1946, he guarded the Hungarian gold train full of looted Jewish treasure. The captain fell in love with a camp survivor and helped her escape to Israel. Now, as his granddaughter sets out to repatriate the necklace, secrets buried in the past are uncovered. Stories of love and deceit are linked to an exquisite peacock-shaped pendant and to a priceless, long-lost painting. The tale, performed by Jonathan Davis and Paul Hecht, is filled with art dealers, freedom fighters, psychoanalysts, and suffragettes. Readers are transported from Budapest 1913 to contemporary Israel.
By now, they had reached the car, a Volvo DL wagon that for 23 years, in the summertime, over breaks and sabbaticals, had ferried first Jack and his wife, then Jack alone, from New York City to Maine and back again. He wondered if it was worth leaving the blue behemoth to Natalie. Like all his possessions, like everything that chance or fate had ever entrusted to his care, he had kept the car in impeccable order. Properly maintained, it might run for years to come. But Natalie might not care to pay the steep New York parking fees. She might, once he was gone, never again care to make the long drive to Red Hook, Maine. And though she was and would always be his tzatzkala, his little treasure, his love for her was as free of illusion as it was of reservation. There was little evidence in the way that she had recently conducted her life to suggest that she knew how to maintain anything at all. "You think you'll want the car?" he said as he opened the driver's side door for her. He walked around, opened his own door, got in and handed her the key. "Or should I put an ad in the paper?" "Don't sell it right now. We'll need it while I'm up here, unless you're planning on coming down to New York. There's hospice here, same as there. Except here, I'm in my own home, and in New York I'd be forced into some misbegotten nursing home, thanks to the grateful generosity of Columbia University." "Grandpa, you weren't really living in that apartment. You were there, like, what, 3 months a year? More like four. They have so many full-time faculty members to house. You can't blame them. 46 years, Natalie. It wouldn't have killed them to make it 46 and a half. She started the engine and then let it idle, warming it up the way his regimen required. They sat listening to the engine in the chill of the car's interior, giving him ample time to regret his bitter words. Having faced or lived through some of the choicest calamities, both personal and world historical, that the 20th century had to offer, Jack Wiseman had rarely given way to bitterness. Until now. He supposed it must be a symptom of the disease that was killing him. "You could stay with me," Natalie said at last. "There's plenty of room now that Daniel's moved out." "I'm here," Jack said, "and you're here now, too."
"Yes."
"Might I ask how long you plan to stay?"
"As long as you need me."
"It shouldn't be too long."
"Grandpa."
"Anyway, good of the firm to let you go."
"I had vacation saved up."
She put the car into reverse with a show, again for his benefit, of checking the rear view and both side mirrors. Then she sighed and put the car back into park. Actually, that's not true. What's not true? I'm not taking my vacation time. I quit.
You quit?
He thumped his hand on the dashboard.
To take care of me, that's absolutely unacceptable, Natalie. I won't allow it.
It wasn't because of you. They would have given me leave. She eased out into the street, speeding up slowly so as not to risk a skid on the icy road, or more likely his reprimand for taking it too fast.
Why then?
He said.
Why?
She sounded exasperated with his question. With herself. Maybe just with having to tell the story again.
That was Love and Treasure by Ayelet Waldman. Francine Prose is the author of 20 works of fiction. Her novel Blue Angel was a finalist for the National Book Award. Her most recent works of nonfiction include the highly acclaimed Anne Frank, The Book, The Life, The Afterlife, and Reading Like a Writer. The recipient of numerous grants and honors, including a Guggenheim and a Fulbright, Prose, who graduated from Radcliffe, is a former president of Penn American Center and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. She's also a visiting professor of literature at Bard College. Francine makes New York City her home. Welcome, Francine, and thank you so much for joining us on the Book Report.
Oh, thank you, too. It's a pleasure.
I've always wondered how a writer chooses their book's opening line. Yours is so magnificent. Quote, last night I visited a club in Montparnasse where men dress as women and the women as men. Papa would have loved it.
Well, that narrator is based very loosely on Brassai, the photographer, and he took a lot of pictures in a club which was really called Le Monocle, the Monocle. And I knew in the novel it was going to be the Chameleon Club. And Brassai wrote letters back to his parents in Hungary. So that part of the novel, or that voice, is based very loosely on the letters he wrote. And I thought, how funny, you know, a young artist in Paris writing back to his middle-class, proper, staid parents in Hungary about going to a cross-dressers club. So, you know, the minute I had that line, I knew I had it.
When you're writing first lines in a novel, do they sort of pop into your brain fully formed, or do you write down 10 and then sort of one comes to the front? I've always wondered, since it's so meaningful to set the tone.
Usually the first line is all I have. I mean, a lot of times it really does start with the first line, and in that case it did. The last line is more difficult, but the first, I've sort of, you know, as soon as I've got that, I can go forward.
Can you give us a brief overview of the story?
Mm-hmm. Well, it takes place in Paris between 1924 and 1944, and a lot of it does take place in this cross-dressers club in Montparnasse, and it follows a group of characters who are all very closely connected, and at the center of the novel is a woman who historically was named Villette Morris, but I call her Lou Villar, who was a French athlete, a professional race car driver, and in 1935, the French government took away her license to compete because she was a cross-dresser. And Hitler somehow found out about this, invited her to be his guest at the Berlin Olympics. She went, she was Hitler's guest, she came back to France spying for the Germans, and she became a worker for the Gestapo when the Germans invaded Paris, and then she was assassinated by the resistance in 1944. So that was the center of the book, really. And then as the book got larger and I was writing it, I realized I had to start way back earlier and go, because I wanted a picture of Paris when it was very, very bright and lively and all these artists and entertainers and great talents were there before it got dark during the occupation.
I've read that you were considering writing this as a nonfiction, yet you chose the novel instead. Why?
Well, for one thing, Violette Morris's story is such a crazy story that I thought no one would believe it if I wrote it as fiction. And that was part of the... But it was... I mean, I knew it wasn't going to be as much fun to do it as nonfiction. But there were... But again, there were so many real people involved. I mean, there's a character loosely based on Henry Miller. There is the Brassai character. Lou Villar does have her roots in a real person. So it could have gone either way, but it was just much more fun to do it this way.
And the Brassai character and the Henry Miller character were actually friends at the time?
Oh, yeah. They were very close. In fact, they wrote books about each other. They rambled around Paris together. And they were both very much nocturnal beasts. So a lot of the pictures Brassai took were came during their rambling all-night walks through Paris.
You would have liked to have been a fly on the wall.
Absolutely. I mean, I think everyone secretly would have loved to have lived in Paris in the 1930s and 20s. So I'm among them.
Me too. So many characters have their own voice in the novel. Gabor, the photographer, Lionel Mayne, the journalist. But you made the decision not to allow Lou to have her own voice. Why?
Well, you know, one of the things the novel is about is the mystery of evil, really. I mean, I didn't realize that when I started out. I just was going to tell a story. But as I began to work on it, I thought, okay, that's what it is. And I was very intent on keeping that mystery. I mean, since then, you know, some readers get it, and some readers say, gee, she should have had her own voice. We should have understood why she did the things she did. Well, there's some reasons that I could trace as to why she did what she did. But finally, you can't understand why someone behaved that way. So I wanted to keep that element of mystery and distance around her.
Yes, in that line of thinking, you've said that she was invited to Berlin to meet Hitler, and she wonders if the Germans wanted her to race for them. She says, would a patriotic French woman mistreated by her country consider driving for Germany, if only to show her deluded homeland that it made a mistake? Are we supposed to feel slightly disappointed for Lou?
Well, I think her character excites, I hope, a whole range of emotions. I mean, there's something sympathetic about her. I meant there to be something sympathetic, and yet she did really terrible things. So so she's complicated the way most people are complicated, but more intensely complicated than most people.
We're speaking with Francine Prose on the Book Report.
What was it like to write dialogue for Hitler?
It was so much fun. It was, well, you know, part of it was kind of borrowed. There's a book called Hitler's Table Talk, and Martin Bormann wrote down everything Hitler said at dinner for, I don't know, over a four-year period. Shatteringly banal. You can hardly believe. And a lot of what he talked about was his diet and his vegetarianism and his preference for a kind of nut cutlet his mother used to make. So I could just put that, you know, change it, of course, but put it directly in the novel. I knew what Hitler said at dinner.
Wow. Your description of Hitler was very hard for me to read. Quote, could some German scientist have found a way to install a high wattage light bulb inside the Führer's head? He emitted 10 times the radiance of a normal human being, and his eyes were 100 times brighter than the cloudy lenses which ordinary humans peered. Lou had never seen a man exude such simple modesty combined with such charisma. Wow.
Well, of course, that's what point of view means, right? I mean, if you're looking at it from the point of view of someone, Lou, who thinks he's a hero, who thinks he's going to promise her a whole new life, who thinks he's going to recognize her in a way that she hasn't been recognized because she's been so disappointed and mistreated, so he is a hero. And part of what I was trying to get at was how he did look to these masses of Germans who followed him, and French people as well.
It was hard to read still, but
it wasn't my point of view, that's for sure.
Lou is a woman who cut off her own breasts in order to be a better race car driver. For such a person, I don't think it was really a leap to find her inflicting torture on her own countrymen.
Well, it's not exactly clear to me. You know, she did it in theory so that she could fit more comfortably behind the wheel of the race cars. But, you know, so much less was known then about the trans community and gender and so forth. And who knows exactly why she did it? I mean, she dressed like a man. She looked in many ways like a man. So I'm sure there was a mixture of motives behind it when she did it.
I loved how Lionel Mayne, as his last news assignment in France, was sent to cover an execution at Versailles. A murderer was to be beheaded on the guillotine. Was this perhaps your commentary on what was ahead for Europe?
Well, yeah, but also, you know, the clip of the execution is on YouTube. You can find it. I mean, I don't suggest anybody actually look for it because it's so horrifying, but it's out there. So I was, you know, a lot of the research I did for the book I actually did on YouTube because you can find amazing news clips and occasional photography from the period. And I found it on YouTube, and I went, oh, it has to go in the novel for that reason. But sure, I mean, the guillotine runs all the way through the novel. I mean, there's a scene where Picasso makes a little drawing of a guillotine that Lionel craves. So, and the guillotine was my way, or one way, of talking about French culture. I mean, French culture is so romanticized and so glorified. Well, as Picasso says, they did invent the guillotine as well. So it's the other side of it.
I see. Of course, the book takes on anti-Semitism. You write, of the 76,000 French Jews who had been deported, only 2,500 came home. Was that factual?
Oh, yeah. All the facts in that part were true. Horrifying, but true.
At the end of the book, Lionel recalls a reunion with Gabor. They are walking and come across a snake swallowing a frog. Gabor says to Lionel, "Take a look. You think only humans are cruel?" That really, for me, reinforced the brutality that surrounds us.
I saw that in my garden. I had no idea how I was going to end the book. And then I was in my garden in upstate New York, and I saw a snake with half of a frog sticking out of its jaws. And the snake couldn't move. The snake had unhinged its jaws, but the frog was too big. And it took forever. I mean, I watched it for 10 minutes. I called my husband. He came for 10 minutes. He took a photograph. And we knew we couldn't save the frog. I mean, it was beyond that. And then I went back to my study, and I thought, oh, okay, I have an end for my novel. So it was, I guess, fortuitous, not for the frog.
What's next for you? Are you already at work on a new novel?
I'm working on a new novel, yes.
Any hint as to what subject matter?
It's about a group that performs children's theater. It's about a theater group.
Okay. Any final thoughts about Lovers at the Chameleon Club?
No, I have to say I was very pleased by the way it was received, and I'm still getting emails and letters from readers that make me very happy.
Well, it's one of my favorite books that I've read this year. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, too.
To hear a sampling of Lovers at the Chameleon Club, check bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of May 24th, 2014. The sparsely populated town of Sweetland rests on the shore of a remote Canadian island. Its slow decline reaches a head when the mainland government offers each islander a generous resettlement package, the sole stipulation being that everyone must leave. Fierce and enigmatic Moses Sweetland, whose ancestors founded the village, is the only one to refuse. As he watches his neighbors abandon the island, he recalls the town's rugged history and its eccentric cast of characters. Michael Crummy, a major Canadian novelist, conjures up the mythical, sublime world of Sweetland's past amid a storm-battered landscape haunted by local lore. John Lee narrates.
Sweetland turned away from the window, as if he could hide from the man by not looking his way. Glimpsed a flash of him as he went to the front door of the house. Heard the knock. No one in the cove ever knocked at a door. He thought to ignore it. But the knock came a second, and then a third time, and he pushed away from the table, went out through the hallway. No one in the cove used their front doors, either. Sweetland's hadn't been opened in years, and he had to jimmy it loose of the frame. The man standing there, lost in the sun's glare, a voice from the nothing where his mouth should be. "Mr. Sweetland?" He waited until the figure resolved out of the light, until he could see the eyes. "Just come off the ferry, did you?"
"Just this second, yes."
Sweetland nodded. "I must be some f***ing important." The government man smiled up at him. "You're at the top of my list." Sweetland stood to one side to let the man by. "Cup of tea." "You don't have coffee by any chance?"
"I got instant."
"Tea is fine," the government man said. Sweetland moved the kettle onto the stove while the young one took a seat at the table. He tried to think of when a stranger sat there last, seeing the kitchen for the first time. Low ceilings, the beams an inch or two clear of Sweetland's crown, painted wood floor, a daybed under one window, a formica table with chrome legs pushed up to the other, his mother's china teacups on hooks below the cupboards. All so familiar to him, he hadn't noticed it in years. The man's briefcase was lying on the table in front of him like a placemat, and Sweetland set a spoon and the sugar bowl on the flat surface of it.
"No sugar for me," the youngster said, setting the bowl to one side. "A drop of milk if you have some."
He put the case on the floor beside his chair.
"No fresh," Sweetland said. "Just 10.
10 is fine," the government man said. He took a blackberry from his coat pocket and held it to the window a moment.
"You're not the fellow was out last time around."
"I just took over the file."
"You won't get a cell phone signal out here," Sweetland told him.
He shrugged. "The edge of the civilized world."
"They was talking about putting up a tower years back. Never got around to it."
The government man gestured past him to the counter.
"You have a laptop there?"
Sweetland glanced over his shoulder to confirm the fact.
"We got the internet for long ago. Does my banking on that," he said. "Bit of online poker. Passes the time."
Sweetland poured the tea and took a seat directly across the table.
"You're not on Facebook, are you?" "Look at this face," he said, and the government man glanced down at the table.
It was an easy road into the subject at hand, and he was surprised the government man didn't take it, smiling out the window instead. Perfect teeth. They all had perfect teeth these days. Careful haircuts. Accents Sweetland couldn't place. This one might be from the mainland somewhere, for all he could tell.
"So," the younger man said abruptly, "are you coming to the meeting this afternoon?"
Sweetland almost laughed.
"Not planning on it, no. I couldn't talk you into it."
"Listen," Sweetland said, "I'm not the only one who voted against this thing."
"That's true. 45 in favor, 3 against, by the most recent ballot. But as of yesterday, yours is the only one of 2 households who have not agreed to take the package we're offering."
"2, Sweetland said. The government man paused there to let the information sink in. He stirred his tea slowly, the clink of the spoon like a broken lever inside a mechanical doll.
"That's just me and Lovelace.
That's where things stand," he said. Sweetland rubbed absently at the tabletop a moment, and then excused himself. He went out through the hall and up the narrow stairs to the bathroom. He put the toilet seat down and sat there a few minutes, leaning an elbow on the windowsill. He could see the back of Lovelace's property from there, the ancient barn, the single gaunt cow with its head to the grass. Lovelace famously drank a pint of kerosene when he was a toddler, which to Sweetland's mind told you everything you needed to know about the man.
That was Sweetland by Michael Crummy. In Leaving Before the Rains Come, Alexandra Fuller, best-selling author of Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, relearns the fearless ways of her father to find her own true north. Standing in the wreckage of her marriage, Fuller revisits the continent she loves and finds the key to her salvation in her father's harsh, simple, and uncompromising ways. Casting a fresh eye on her parents' boisterous strengths and debilitating weaknesses, Fuller, who narrates, paints a vivid picture of her adopted America and reveals her Africa as vital and resilient.
"The only birds I could see were an industrious banditry of black-capped chickadees at the suet feeder. They seemed robustly ascetic little creatures, like tiny chattering monks. I'd read they were able to lower their body temperature by up to 12 degrees on cold winter nights to conserve energy. Torpor was the word the bird books used. Hummingbirds supposedly did the same thing, but they also had to eat 60 times their body weight a day just to stay alive, at least according to a fragment of a poem by Charles Wright I kept above my computer. Now that's a life on the edge," the fragment concludes. "I have to go," I said. But Vanessa had begun to expand on her vision for Dad's funeral arrangements, and she was in full voice now. Should there be an old Land Rover or a donkey cart for a hearse? And was that Polish priest from Old Makushi still alive? The one who had been at my wedding? Because he had lived in the bush long enough not to blink, if we had asked him to have the service under a baobab tree instead of in a church, right? And perhaps we could get people from the villages to make a choir. There are heaps of those apostles all over the place, Vanessa pointed out. But do they sing? Or do they just sit around draped in white bedsheets moaning? I said I didn't know, but I'd never forget the time Mum got in dust-up with the apostle who'd moved onto the edge of the farm with his several wives and his scores of children, and whose vegetable plot had strayed onto her overflowing pet cemetery. Mum had yelled obscenities, planted her walking stick in the soil, and declared turf war. In return, the apostle had thrown rocks at Mum's surviving dogs, brandished his staff, and recited bellicose passages from the Old Testament. An apoplectic apostolic, Mum had reported with relish, although her neck had been out for weeks after the apostle shook her, just like a Jack Russell with a rat. Vanessa took another considered drag off her cigarette. Oh, right, she said. I'd forgotten about that. Maybe Catholics might be better after all. They'll know proper hymns. Plus, Catholics have wine at intermission, don't they? And Mum doesn't have a history of battling them, does she? Not yet, I said. And what about entertainment for afterwards, Vanessa asked. People will have driven for days. They'll be expecting a thrash. It'll have to be a huge party from beginning to end, with a calypso band, Harry Belafonte, and buckets of rum punch. Perhaps we could organize boat races on the Zambezi in dugout canoes. That would be groovy. And what about a greasy pole over one of Mum's fish ponds for the especially inebriated mourners? Because you know it's going to be alcoholics unanimous from beginning to end. And maybe we could have a maze like the one we had at Mum and Dad's 40th anniversary, Vanessa said. Remember? I would never forget that either. There'd been shots of something fairly stiff at the entrance to the maze, and some guests got so drunk right off the bat they were stranded in dead ends until dawn. But I didn't bring this up, nor did I say that I thought Vanessa's suggestions were murderously bad. How many funerals did she want in 1 week? In the interests of time, mine chiefly, I said I thought they were all ideas worth considering. That is, when Dad is actually dead, I said. And then I added, in a way that I hope suggested a signing off. Okay, Van, I'm quite busy here. But Vanessa wouldn't be deterred. She poured herself another glass of wine and rattled on. No, 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 she said. We have to plan now. We'll be too distraught at the time. She reminded me she wouldn't be able to do any of the readings because she was illiterate, as well we all knew. Mum certainly couldn't do a reading or much of anything because she would be an inconsolable wreck. And Richard shouldn't be allowed anywhere near a pulpit. He'll just grunt and growl and terrify the congregation, Vanessa said. No, Al, when Dad dies, you're going to have to do the urology.
We've just heard Leaving Before the Rains Come by Alexandra Fuller. Vikram is not your model Indian-American teenager. Growing up in Wisconsin in the late 1980s, he is rebellious, adrift, and resentful of his Indian roots. But after a disastrously drunken weekend, Vikram is hustled back to the homeland after his outraged parents decide to pack up the family and return to India. The scene is set in Jay Antony's The Leaving of Things. Vikram begins a profound journey of culture shock, loneliness, and self-discovery. Vikram must navigate the chaos of daily Indian life and the antiquated social rules of his college. He'll find the confidence to explore his own creativity, reconnect with his family, and meet new friends. Most of all, Vikram discovers that India is his soul, but America is his heart, the land of his destiny. He must confront a once-in-a-lifetime test of courage as he charts a new course for his future. Sanjeev Javeri narrates.
I glared again at my father. He seemed so focused, so delighted to be back in India. You see, he had grown up in Ahmedabad. In fact, we had lived in Ahmedabad before we'd left for America 11 years ago. And it was there that my father expected my brother and me to settle right back in. Anand into the eighth grade, and me into my first year of college. And my mother, you ask? She'd worn her favorite salwar kameez today. So tickled she must have been to be back here. No doubt she was in league with my father. I decided I wanted nothing more to do with either of them. A frowning immigration officer stamped our passports. We collected our things, two large and two small suitcases, and went inside the customs hall. Packed with worn-out travelers and about the size of my high school gym. It smelled like it, too. Inspectors on the far side of the hall picked through passports, paperwork, everybody's baggage like scavengers. Anand, what are you doing? My father asked sharply. My brother had unbuckled his suitcase and was rooting through it.
Not now, beta, my mother said.
But then my brother found what he was looking for. His brewer's cap. He slid off his headphones and slipped it on. Why bothered with that now? My father shook his head, half amused, half irritated. He sized up the lines in the customs hall. 45 minutes, he said.
45,
my mother shot back.
This will take 2 hours minimum.
My father turned to her and scoffed.
You're sure of everything, aren't you?
Our connection to Ahmedabad left in 3 hours from the domestic terminal. I asked how far that was.
Far,
my mother said. My father pushed strands of thinning hair across his scalp and with a long sigh admitted,
Yes, it's far.
As long as we were waiting, I figured I'd better shoot some video. Since leaving Wisconsin, when was that? Yesterday? I'd been recording footage for a kind of video journal. My own first-hand reports on what it felt like to go from home sweet home America, across Europe, and on to the far Indian tropics. I planned on mailing the tapes to my best friends, Nate and Carl, and my girlfriend, Shannon, every month. So I took the camera out of the case and panned across the hall, across the sea of faces. Mostly brown faces, surrounding me. Some I recognized as tired fathers, much like my own father, in spectacles, short sleeves, and mustaches. I saw women who resembled my own mother, in their salwar kameez clutching purses and duffel bags. They all stood silently or in tense conversation, tending to their luggage and their children. They all looked so miserable. And here I was, no different from them. I was one of them. That got me dreading my fate even more, so I put the camera away and sat next to Anand on one of the suitcases, hoping for conversation. His headphones pulled over his brewer's cap, Anand bobbed his head, drumming his fingers on the suitcase and humming to the tune that filled his head. Who are the Brewers playing this weekend? I asked him as cheerfully as I could.
White Sox,
Anand said, without even turning to me.
Last game of the series.
He resumed his humming, his drumming. I left him to it. But I couldn't keep it bottled up like Anand. I needed to talk, to stay braced against my anxiety. I glanced at my father again. There he stood, oblivious as ever to Anand and me. One hand at his hip and the other picking at his mustache, staring intently at the front of the line. I turned to my mother, who had propped herself atop a suitcase, tapping her chin. Are you happy? I asked. I mean, happy to be here?
Mm-hmm,
she said absently, without looking at me. I didn't believe her. Didn't want to.
We've just heard The Leaving of Things by Jay Antoni. Set against the backdrop of the English Lake District in the 1960s and the upheavals of revolutionary Russia, Freda Lightfoot's The Amber Keeper is a tale of jealousy and revenge, reconciliation and forgiveness. After her mother's suicide, Abby Myers returns home to the Lake District with her young child. Estranged from her turbulent family, Abby is brokenhearted when she hears they blame her for the family tragedy. Abby turns to her grandmother in an attempt to uncover her mother's past. The old woman reveals the story of how she traveled to Russia in 1911 as a young governess and became caught up in the revolution. As Abby struggles to reconcile with her family, she realizes those long-ago events created aftershocks that must be dealt with before she's able to find peace. Susan Dwerden narrates.
Clouds hung heavy over the crags and fells as rain drizzled down on a miserably cold March day, as it generally does at funerals. It had taken over 2 weeks to reach this stage, with a post-mortem and inquest to be dealt with before the coroner was able to release the body for burial. Now Abby stood holding her grandmother's arm at the graveside, marvelling at how composed she was. But then, she'd always been a strong woman, a no-nonsense sort of person who never made a fuss. What she must be suffering inside was no doubt a different story. The vicar gave a long address about how much Kate Myers had generously contributed to the church and community in her role as secretary of the Mothers Union and treasurer of the Women's Institute, and by serving on the committee of the local Dr. Bernardo's home. Abby knew nothing of this part of her mother's life, and despite herself, was deeply impressed. It was astonishing that Kate could manage to be so involved in such matters, on top of running the family handmade jewellery business. How sad, though, that it should take her death to reveal this charitable side of her nature. Yet, if she'd cared for children so much, why had she never shown any interest in meeting her own granddaughter? The presence of the children, in fact, brought a welcome blast of fresh air and gentle laughter into the sombre household as people gathered for the usual wake. Ignorant of the circumstances that had brought the family together, young Jonathan chatted away 20 to the dozen, telling anyone prepared to listen how excited he was to be starting school after Easter. 18-month-old Carrie didn't sit still for a second, happily poking into corners, emptying ladies' handbags, and pulling open every drawer and cupboard door she could get her small, chubby fists on. When her mother took her upstairs to put her down for her afternoon nap, she happily scattered Johnson's baby powder all over the bathroom floor. Abby laughingly cleaned it up, while Faye attempted to put a nappy on the toddler, now indulging in a screaming tantrum. Oh, she's coming up to the terrible twos. I remember it well. Emma was just the same. Fortunately, at six, she's now an absolute treasure. Skillfully folding and pinning the terry towel nappy in place, Faye said. But something of an embarrassment still, I should imagine. Why would she be? She's the joy of my life. I mean, since your daughter is, well, what she is. Abby instantly sobered. You mean illegitimate? Robert chose that moment to appear at the bedroom door.
Don't attempt to deny it. I see no wedding ring in evidence. Admit it, Abby. You've screwed up big time, and Ma has paid the price.
His words stunned her into silence for a whole half minute. Abby had been mildly startled by the sight of her brother after all this time, looking much older than his 28 years. There was already the odd fleck of grey in his brown hair, and he'd developed quite a paunch and signs of a double chin. Clearly, all those smart lunches he must attend as a successful accountant were beginning to have an effect. But his sense of self-importance was as evident as ever. Faye hastily pulled a pair of frilly plastic panties over the nappy, then shooed brother and sister out of the room so that she could settle Carrie for her nap. Robert and Abby stood facing each other out on the landing with expressions as dark as thunder.
So you start on me the minute I arrive. Nice to see you too. Thanks for that, brother dear. Bit unfair, don't you think, to blame me when I've been living away from home for 7 years?
You can't deny you were responsible for her unhappiness.
Oh, change the record, please, Carrie responded, keeping her voice low so as not to disturb little Carrie or reveal how upset she was. Why would Mum suddenly decide now that she can no longer live with the shame of my scandalous teenage behaviour after all this time?
That was a sampling of The Amber Keeper by Freda Lightfoot. The Moonlight Palace by Liz Rosenberg is a coming-of-age tale set in Singapore of the 1920s. Agnes Hussein is the descendant of the last Sultan of Singapore and the last surviving member of her immediate family. She's grown up among her eccentric relatives in the crumbling Kampong Glam Palace, a once opulent relic given to her family in exchange for handing over Singapore to the British. Now Agnes is 17 and her family has fallen into genteel poverty, surviving on her grandfather's pension and the meager income they receive from a varied cast of boarders. As outside forces conspire to steal the palace from them, Agnes struggles to save her family. As her quest continues, she finds bravery, love, and loyalty in the most unexpected places. Amy McFadden performs the book.
It is a bad thing, Nene Down would grumble. They pretend it means nothing, but down means lower. I am treated like an underling in my own house, only because my husband cannot climb the stairs. What's more, she is not your true grandmother. She is merely your great aunt. You should call her Nene Never Was and Never Will Be. Yet no one grieved harder when little Nene Up passed away, not even Uncle Chachi, the widower. Nene Down was fiercely inconsolable. She visited the Buddhist temple on Eng Hoon Street 3 times a day, lighting red candles and saying prayers. She lost so much weight, she looked like a little white bird swallowed up in the robes of mourning.
She was my best friend, Nene Down keened. She was my Chinese sister, my little darling. No one will ever understand me as she did.
This was probably true. Their passionate quarrels, their petty jealousies, their tender truces. No one in the household knew what to make of them. The two old women argued, fought, and made up together in a Peranakan Chinese language all their own, like the language of twins. And the rest of the family could make out only a word here and there, gremlin, or extreme beauty, or monkey brains. Nene Down was lost for a time without her nemesis. Her people, those of her generation, were dying out, and I kept forgetting that I no longer needed to call her Nene Down. She was now my one and only Nene. Still, the habit stuck.
Nene dear, I would say, or Nene darling,
but I never could pull it off.
Never mind the endearments, Nene would say, tapping hard on the back of my hand.
Her fingertips reminded me of a woodpecker's beak.
Just call me Nene. That's easy enough to remember.
And grandfather, her husband, would chuckle softly. He was born and raised in the posh West End of London in the 19th century. He still carried a brolly whenever he went outside, even when he was rolled out by Nene Down in his wooden wheelchair. She treated him like a precious baby. She never let him go out in the rain, though he carried a lifelong fondness for damp weather along with his umbrella. Most often, he ended up using it as a parasol against the hot Singapore sun. British grandfather was our most distinguished family member. I was foolishly, vainly proud of him. When he could still walk, he stood nearly 6'4" in his stocking feet, which made him stand out shockingly in Singapore, where the people were short and small-boned. I was named Agnes after his mother. Agnes was a strange name for a Singapore mixed breed like me. I am one half Chinese, one quarter Indian Muslim, and one quarter British, so you can imagine what I look like. Dark-haired, petite, with a small mouth,
strangely pale gold skin, and dark grayish eyes that changed with my mood and the weather. Singaporeans had trouble pronouncing the name Agnes, so it was shortened to Aggie. Not by British grandfather, however. He remembered to call me Agnes, even when he had forgotten everything else he had been, done, or wanted. Once he asked me if I was the pretty young nurse sent over by the hospital. Even then he called me Agnes. British grandfather was the happiest member of our extended Kampong Glam family. Even when we were dead broke, and we always were, he seemed not to know it. His pale blue eyes crackled with life, and he was always effusing over something that he'd seen through his bedroom window, or up in the sky, or lying in the gutter of Arab Street. One day it was a stick of gum wrapped in foil. Probably it had fallen out of the coat of some American, but I snuck it into the pocket of Grandfather's cashmere wrapper and made him promise not to put it in his mouth. "Can't chew," he said, clicking his teeth at me with a grin. "False uppers."
We have just heard The Moonlight Palace by Liz Rosenberg. Three Daughters by Consuelo Saw Bear chronicles the lives, loves, and secrets of three generations of Palestinian Christian women. Born in rural Palestine just before the dawn of the 20th century, Miriam adores her father and is certain his love will protect her. She soon finds that tradition overrides love. Uprooted by war, Miriam enters a world where the old constraints slip away with thrilling and disastrous results. Miriam's rebellious daughter, Nadia, dreams of pursuing a modern life that her elite education has shown her. But when she falls in love with an outsider, the clan reins her back in with shocking finality. Nijma, Nadia's daughter, finds the path her father, the Sheikh, sets for her is fraught with difficulties, yet it prepares her for the ultimate journey to America, where she finds her future. Each woman, in her own time and in her own way, experiences a world in transition through war and social change, and each must stretch the bounds of her courage and her heart. Karen Peaks performs the book.
Miriam and Mustafa left for the school early one morning down the El Tira Road, going past the fine, orderly vineyards that grew the best grapes in Judea. The road curved down, and they could see that the cement in the paved roofs had cracked from the summer heat. There would be leaks with the first showers of fall. Nabiha tucked a bag of sweets into Miriam's pocket. "Eat them on the way, Habibi," she said, and began to cry. Jamila embraced Miriam briefly, but was distracted by keeping the twins, George and Salim, from straying down the road. The trip to Sirona took 2 days. Miriam, looking pale, began to lag toward dusk, and Mustafa carried her to a hostel in Lud, where they spent the night. In the morning, their breakfast was goat's milk cheese, bread with oil and thyme, and tea. They took food for the road. Every so often they would stop, moved by the sights of the pomegranate and mulberry orchards and the palm trees, which Miriam had never seen. They passed the ruins of many soap factories now in decay. They were used to walking barefoot and saved the sandals for the villages. The difficulty came with the dust. The pulverized limestone that leached out of the striated buttes invaded their noses, eyes, and mouths, and Miriam had difficulty swallowing. She stopped frequently, and Mustafa looked back to keep her in sight. As they got nearer to the sea, the temperature increased but remained dry. They came to the first station of the new railroad from Jaffa to Jerusalem. The locomotive rumbled by, halted, discharged a passenger, and went again. Mustafa was delighted. He took a small leap into the air, and they waited until it was out of sight before continuing to Sirona. The school was unmistakable. The area was landscaped with orderly rows of palm trees and formal approaches to the main building, which was made of smooth, flush stone with double-height arched windows. A gardener stared at them disdainfully.
"Mogbari?"
he asked, taking them for itinerant Muslims working their way through the villages on the pilgrimage to Mecca. Miriam shook her head.
"This is a school for Muslims," he informed them. "Rich Muslim girls."
Miriam ignored him and looked at her father, who was filthy with dust. She tucked her hair behind her kerchief and put on a colorful vest from her sack. The inside of the building was a revelation. The floors were made of polished wood. Wood! There were divans against the walls for sitting. Miss Clay, the headmistress, was taller than her father. Ma'asalami, she said. Mustafa didn't answer, and Miriam pointed to the inside of her mouth. No speak. Her voice surprised the teacher, and to make matters worse, Mustafa began gesticulating. Miriam reddened, but then she saw Miss Clay moving her hands in the same way. Mustafa smiled and seemed satisfied to leave his daughter. When he walked away, Miriam cried into her scarf and ran after him. He made a little maneuver of leaving and then returning to let her know he would be back to visit, and she went inside. First, said Miss Clay, ignoring the tears, we must have a bath. Maha, the maid, was the first to enter her room in the morning. She took one look at the mattress on the floor and shook her head in disgust. Stupid, she chided Miriam, who was startled to be attacked by one of her own kind. Maha appeared to be a villager like herself. If she sees what you've done with the bed, you'll go right back. Curiosity fought with pride, but finally won. What's wrong? She had pulled the mattress to the floor as it was at home. It belongs on the bedstead, stupid Christian. Instead of cowing Miriam, Maha's attack gave her new determination. She had been selected to be a pupil, while Maha was just the maid.
That was Three Daughters by Consuelo Saw-Bear. Readers, I'm sure you'll agree, books are a fabulous gateway to begin to explore the world's far-flung spots. For more titles guaranteed to transport you to exotic locales, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.